As it has been many years since we've played, let's start this reunion game with a recap of the rules.
If you're looking for a gamble, or at the very least you're guaranteed the time of your life, then I have another opportunity to tell you about.
Tell me more about this game.
What we want to play! Right, Brian?
We're all in.
Yeah, plus we'll add a couple of new players.
7 seems acceptable. 10,000 per person.
Let's make it 5. I'm just a poor, corrupt official.
Even if I say yes, there'll be one short. So maybe the game won't happen.
If you didn't want to play, then why did you even come here tonight?
Because I was hoping to change your minds.
I won't be the one that lets everyone down.
Lets everybody down? They're manipulating you.
So you think I should play?
And I think I should be there to witness you.
You're sick, you know that?
Look, I just want to win the game, and winning won't mean as much if I don't beat the guy who won last time.
I'm married.
What would your wife say if she knew about the game?
She never will know.
That is, unless one of us tells her about it.
You always look at a woman's ring finger?
And she looks like you, I do.
I'm married.
That's okay, I'm not the jealous type.
You think this is the first time that I've gotten this kind of proposition?
Well, then just, you know, tell me to go to hell.
No, I can't.
What did you do this time?
You're gonna hate me.
But what do we know about fear? Where there's fear,
there's desire. What would possess you to play a game like this?
I wish like hell I knew.
Whoever's doing this knows about this game.
What the hell are you doing here?
You work just as bad as I am. I'm worse.
What do you mean he's dead?
All right. Who wants to go first?
7 men, several crimes, violence, murder, mystery, misogyny. It is just a game. It is just a movie. It is just locker room talk. The Lady Killers has a preview screening on Sunday, the 19th of March at 7 p.m. at the Olendar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance in Malibu, an incredible home and the studio of our friend, artist Lee McCloskey. Email us for details, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. The film will be having its official world premiere on Sunday, the 26th of March at 9:10 p.m. at the Lemley NoHo 7 as part of North Hollywood Cinefest, and tickets are on sale now at nohocinefest.com.
And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Dean Haglund, are you old enough to remember last week's show?
Oh my gosh, it was as if it just happened last week.
Yeah, and we had a special guest, Carl Frunz, who is one of the founders and organizers of the Prisoner Con 2017.
Yes, so exciting.
We celebrated
fans of the Prisoner.
Yeah, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the most intelligent, thought-provoking entertainment series ever created, and I just wanted
After the Exiles. Never mind.
I can edit that out. And then I just wanted to follow up and point out that The X-Files had a show called The Field Where I Died, so that eliminates that from the conversation right there. But I wanted to follow up on last week's show with Carl to point out that Carl is quite kindly filling in for me this week on Alex Lefchuk's Midweek Drive program for Siren FM in the UK. You know, I'm a weekly fixture there on that show.
Yes, I know you're a big deal in that you're kind of a big deal over there.
Oh, in that transatlantic link kind of way. I have a big Los Angeles Breakfast Club Foundation meeting. I'm on the board of trustees of the foundation. We do a lot of good works, support a lot of community organizations and programs. And so I'm going to be unable to make my usual weekly appearance there. And so Carl's going to fill in, and he's going to talk to the Midweek Drive audience all about The Prisoner and Prisoner Con. So won't that be fun?
That would be fun.
Speaking of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, Dean, as you well know, I have a new podcast.
Yes.
It's
so...
have you enjoyed
it? Well-produced, I was going to say.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, you say that like you're surprised.
you know, some of our audio technician issues are...
Yeah,
prevalent.
If we could just get our hands on the audio technician, we might be able to handle some of those issues. The Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the air is a tribute to the days of yesteryear when the LABC was a fixture on the radio, and it's a monthly review and preview of happenings at the Democracy of Ham and Eggs. And I bring it up because I know many of our listeners listened to that first episode because it showed up in their iTunes feed through your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Well, now LABC, the Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the air, has its own site and its own feeds. And if anybody wants to continue to enjoy that show, we now have two episodes available. They can find it at labreakfastclub.libsyn.com. labreakfastclub.libsyn.com. Now, Dean, before we leap into an email from a listener, I wanted to ask you, you have some interesting travels coming up in May. Is it true you're going to be in Texas?
Yes, Dallas. We're going to be at a convention May 26th and 7th. The name of the convention is off the top of my tongue. It's in my calendar, but it's going to be good. And all three of the Lone Gunmen are going to be there. One of our rare appearances where all three of us will be there signing stuff. So... anybody in the sound of my voice who wants anything gunman-related, triple side, get your plane ticket to Dallas.
And it is certainly my intention to be there. We will probably record a podcast, maybe with Bruce and Tom. That would be fun. We did one many years ago, and it would be fun to follow up on that. And, of course, we'll do a little shooting, a little discussion for Truth Is Out There, too. So, anyway, I'll post some links to that, and we'll update people. Also, if what I read is true, and the rumors are always true, we know this, Dean Hagland is going to have an art showing in Los Angeles in July?
Well, yes, this is the Fine Art Gallery. What we're looking to do, they go month by month, so the show has to be submitted for approval, but pending approval, I will have a solo exhibition of my paintings from the Broadway tour book. So for those who are in the know, I self-published a book called The Illustrated Walking Tour of Downtown Los Angeles, and all the fine historic theaters of Broadway and downtown LA, I paint it, and then have sort of basically how I gave the walking tour in book form. And so I'll be selling the book there, and then the original art from the book will be up on the walls, plus some new pieces that I will be creating.
That sounds very exciting. We're looking forward to that. And one last item on the agenda, because we've had special theme shows the last couple weeks. So that's why I'm trying to catch everybody up on all the news that they can use. Before we get to our views and reviews, I wanted to ask you, apropos of self-publishing books, is there a graphic novel in our future?
Oh, there sure is. It's getting closer. Every second that I'm not podcasting, I'm working on that thing. So Yes. Yes, it's getting closer. It's just about, you know, workflow and technology. I'm sitting here looking at a pile of computer parts and the hard drive that my stuff is on that have to all be plugged into this new computer. Because as you know, the old computer just bought the farm. And so I quickly pulled the hard drives out of it before the whole thing smoked out. And now I got to reassemble a brand new piece. Some fun, eh?
Dear Phil and Dean, this email begins.
Yay!
I'm in the middle of listening to my Chill Pack Hollywood Hour episode 509. Not yet quite to your thoughts on the Academy Awards nominations. There's been good discussion and fun had, but I'm hearing callbacks to Sergio Leone and the Man with No Name trilogy, and for some reason a callback to 50 Shades of Grey. At this point, I had arrived home from work and left the rest of the program for my next outing. Of course, a thought lingers. What if 50 Shades of Grey had been made into an Italian spaghetti trilogy? Would the titles end up something like 50 Shades of Grey for a few shades more and the good, the bad, and the gray? Not that this matters. It's just a curiosity. My true reason for writing to you is to ask a question which I've wanted to ask for a while. Whenever you discuss what you're reading, feel free to cue up Garrett Watley. Actually, it is not Garrett Watley. It's John Lawler, formerly of the B-Film Extras, and consider him cued. No. I note that much of what you read is non-fiction. Nothing wrong with that, especially if that's what gets your juices flowing.
Right.
But do you ever read anything? Let me stop there. Do you want to address why it is that you... because it is true that certainly of recent vintage, when we discuss what we're reading, it does seem almost always to be nonfiction. Not always, but often. Is there a reason, Dean, that do you feel that you are gravitating more towards nonfiction than fiction? And if so, is there a reason behind it?
Well, let's think about that. I mean, I guess... you know, when you are an improviser, you want to have a ton of information at the ready to throw into scenes at the drop of a hat. So you want to be well-read or well-rounded. And perhaps with my lack of, what shall I say, mediated forms of education, I am maybe gravitating towards more nonfiction at the moment. But that said... I don't think it's a conscious trend. I think I'm just sort of picking up what's serendipitously falls in front of me sort of thing. So I don't.
Although getting back,
going out of my way, out of my fiction.
Getting back to our discussion of 2 weeks ago when we revisited The Truth Is Out There, of course, we do attract what it is we need. So it doesn't just fall in front of you. Right. I think, look, as a comedian, to stay relevant, one wants to stay au courant. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, what would you say? It doesn't mean necessarily news, right?
Right.
But it certainly needs to be like what you were alluding to, just constantly building and growing and expanding your own educational basis from
yeah.
which to draw on. And I would say the same thing is true for doing a weekly podcast. And a weekly radio program in the UK. And for, look, my last film that I made was a dark comedy, right? I mean, to me, the inspiration for comedy needs to come from really real world stuff. What's the difference between drama and comedy? I think comedy should be more real than drama.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think there's that. I think it's not that we eschew fiction or narrative forms, but to a degree, our fiction and our narratives are fueled by nonfiction. And at the same time, I flash back to, it wasn't that many years ago where to compile a list of best films of the year, you and I were relying heavily on documentaries. And and that was at a time when Dean Hagland actually saw a lot of movies, too.
remember that?
But it really, we were at a point where, look, we love character. We appreciate filmmakers who understand that story flows out of characters. And there was a real patch of time there where there was a dearth of especially American movies that were character-driven. And when we wanted to find interesting characters, we found them in nonfiction formats. And I think that that's still true in books to a degree. I find many of the characters depicted in nonfiction books to be more compelling than their fictional counterparts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, our present reality seems so outlandish that even if you put that into a fiction form, nobody would believe it. They would go, really? A president who was a reality star? That seems a bit over the top. And then, you know, so hence why your wild characters, your believable characters, are in a nonfiction format that that are more than fiction, is what I'm saying.
So there has been one big exception for me in terms of reading nonfiction, and I'm not mentioning it because it also is an answer to the second part of this listener's question. Do you ever read anything that isn't a script that falls into the speculative side of fiction, or perhaps fantasy or science fiction? I know you've mentioned reading classics of sci-fi in your youths. I think we once did a show about our favorite science fiction books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But I was curious if you keep up with it, or do you prefer to make slash watch that sort of thing for in the cinema? And again, this does underscore what we were just saying, that some of our fuel for fiction has to come from less speculative depictions of subjects in print, because it's the basis for our understanding and our ability, therefore, to root things, no matter how outlandish, how comedic, how satiric, whatever, how speculative, but to root it as much in reality as possible. But has there been, I guess, science fiction that you've read, Dean, lately, or that you want to read?
Not that I've read lately. I realize, the Amber Book of Nines by Rogers Lansley is being made into a TV miniseries or a TV series. So how much did I love that book? You know, I touted that as
you wanted to be involved. You wanted to be involved in making that into something.
I know, and I'm out of the loop on that in a big way. But that made me realize that I should revisit the last couple of novels in that series, because it dawns on me that I didn't complete that whole thing reading the synopsis about it. So, that said, you know what we didn't bring here to Australia when we moved from Los Angeles was our entire library of science fiction. So understandably, we're not accumulating a large library here, because then we'd have to cart that back with us when we move back to LA. So
you're operating strictly on the take a book, leave a book methodology.
I got to say, is a big thing here in Sydney. There, about every three or four blocks, they have the library houses on utility poles. So these are little take a book, give a book, free neighborhood library. And any book you're finished with or you're going to throw out, you put in this little box that has a little glass door on it. And everybody's welcome to go in there and peruse, take the book. And then once you're finished, you can put it back or you can hang on to it. It's sort of a free exchange of books throughout the neighborhood. I've seen about 15 to 20 of them just walking the dog.
Now, the most recent science fiction book that I have read, speculative fiction book, is also one that I'd been talking about a great deal over the last few months, and that is The Secret History of Twin Peaks by Mark Frost.
Oh, right.
So that falls squarely into the realm of speculative fiction. Before that, off the top of my head, the last really, really compelling work of speculative fiction that I have read was China Melville's The City and the City. And I spoke about that on the show. And it's a very interesting book. And like all really great science fiction and speculative fiction, a terrific allegory for where we exist and live presently. That answers the question from LeJean Johnson, the venerable Pooh, who signs off his email with a quote from J.C. Hutchins: every writer on the planet thinks of themselves as a hack, and if they don't, they should. So now, yeah. How about we talk about what we're reading? John Lawler, take us away. I have dropped back into the nonfiction world for The Daily Show, the book, an oral history as told by Jon Stewart, the correspondent, staff, and guests to author Chris Smith. And I must say, I'm not a big fan of the oral history book. I appreciate in this day and age where everything is fake news and alternative facts and all of this, it's helpful to be able to say, look, this is what they said. This may not be the facts, but this is a factual representation of how they represented what took place, right? And then right. And then you can assess, did the author go wide and deep enough in terms of finding perhaps contradictory viewpoints or supportive viewpoints? And so this book is painstakingly researched in terms of getting everybody involved to talk and talk at length and to be quite revealing. That said, I don't really enjoy it because, there's a real artistry to writing nonfiction, and there is no artistry in just cutting and pasting an oral history.
Oh, is that all it is? There's no context?
There is context. There's facts, but that at best comes off like a textbook in between the oral history.
Ew.
So I'm just saying that I don't. I enjoy when, look, these people who worked on it are thoughtful people, they're intelligent people, they're funny people, sometimes they're shockingly awful people. I mean, there's interesting things in it. I'm just saying I don't particularly enjoy reading an oral history.
No. Well, I can understand that. I mean, sometimes when you discuss comedy, it's the dreariest, terriblest thing. And particularly once you analyze it and study like comedy for a craft for a living, you tend to now see through the jokes and you see its structure and the magic goes away. So,
well, we've talked about this before, that to a degree, right? Talking about form, talking about process, talking about these things is only interesting for so long. And at some point, I've used the joke, it'd be better to dance about architecture. It'd be better to do an artistic expression to reveal your understanding of that other artistic expression over there.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I guess my point is, write a book then. Don't cut and paste the transcripts of your interviews. But anyway.
That seems lazy.
It's still interesting. It's still interesting. And maybe, and honestly, again, the era in which we live, I don't know if you can write a book in any other way, a nonfiction book in any other way, without being under constant attack for having lied or misleading or anything like that. So what are you reading, Dean?
Well, I mentioned my computer died, of course, and so I bought a bunch of parts. And, some of them, the instruction manuals are just a page or two. But here's a large book, Maximus 8 Hero Motherboard Installation User Guide from Osis, In Search of the Incredible, the DIY Guide to Your Motherboard. This tome is, 15 chapters, each chapter 40 to 45 pages long. Including such exciting topics as platform miscellaneous configuration and how to overclock, plus who could forget Mobo Connect and push notice. So a lot of those things I'm reading, all about the motherboard.
I heard that Ridley Scott is adapting this as his next prequel to Alien, and he's going to have Ian Holm play motherboard.
Might as well, because that's what I'm assembling here on the dining room table in Sydney.
Wow, that is the most unusual selection for what we're reading I think we've ever done on this show. Hats
off.
But
I'm serious. This is now day five of reading. I take this thing. I read it before I go to sleep. I pour over it with the motherboard in front of me to try to figure out what the hell they're talking about. And I think I'm halfway there. So far, I put in the CPU, and it hasn't blown up.
From the death of your computer to several celebrities whose bodies are piled up in the hall, let's get to it. It's a little something we call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
That was very exciting. Apparently, they didn't think we'd ever get to them, so that's why they... hey, Bill Paxton. We didn't get a chance to talk about Bill Paxton because we were doing a special theme show. Paxton was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas. Did you know that he was in the crowd when President John F. Kennedy emerged from the Hotel Texas on the morning of his assassination on November 22nd, 1963? And that photographs of an 8-year-old Bill Paxton being lifted above the crowd are on display at the 6th Floor Museum in Dallas, Texas?
Come on. I've been to that museum. I can't believe I didn't look for that little picture of the young Bill Paxton.
Yes.
I'll have to
photographs,
go
back. Plural, not little picture, man. Photographs, plural. Apparently. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised if they were on his demo reel, if they're that exciting. Anyway, look, early bit parts for Bill Paxton include Stripes, which I just caught on cable again recently, The Terminator, before he makes his mark as Chet in Weird Science. And I think that was really the one that that catapulted him. And then the very next year, of course, Private William Hudson in Aliens.
Good.
On television is where he would be award-nominated multiple times for his work on the miniseries The Bright Shining Lie, for HBO's series Big Love, for the History Channel miniseries The Hatfield and the McCoys. But still, I will always think of him as a big-screen character actor. And for me, I'm going to throw out three of my... favorite of his cinematic turns, and I invite you maybe to share if you have any, Dean. My three are going to be Apollo 13, which is my favorite Ron Howard movie, and I just love the detail of it. And boy, there's no reason why we should believe Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton, and Kevin Bacon are these real life astronauts, because they're so... actors. They're such movie actors, right? But we, for some reason, we do, and their chemistry and their camaraderie and even their fighting and their bickering. I mean, it just works. And Bill Paxton is quite good in Apollo 13. A very different movie, a low budget independent crime movie that was made by Sam Raimi and written by Billy Bob Thornton, A Simple Plan.
Oh, yes, of course.
One of the great dark crime movies of the 90s. Oh. And then finally, a very recent film, a dark comedy, though it was not pitched that way. You know, it's one of my favorites of the last several years. It's Nightcrawler. And Bill Paxton, again, playing just a seedy news gatherer who becomes a rival to Jake Gyllenhaal's character.
Yeah.
It's a terrific performance, a great movie. Any standout performances or films strike
well,
you?
Well, you know, it's his military stuff that I loved. Edge of Tomorrow, what I call it, Live, Die, Repeat.
Yes, sure.
I liked him a lot in that one. And, of course, how many times did we quote him from Aliens, going, oh no, man, we're all gonna die.
Yeah.
Like at any panic moment, that was like our go-to comedy bit, over and over again.
It's so funny. It's like he was so. It's weird because he was believable in military roles, and yet almost always playing the military guy you would not want to be stationed with.
Absolutely, sort of the guy who's on edge, about to lose control. Yet sort of hard ass, but. You know, you could see that it's like he had that in the back of his eyes, this weariness that and yet a sense of humor and all of that. It was really a great mix and really came handy when you played these military guys. What else? I can't off the top of my head. It was those ones mostly.
Sure.
Terminator, of course. He's the punk leader. That was so funny. Because he's in a lot of small things, right?
Yeah, I mean, he worked regularly, so many movies. And, of course, his long-running connection with James Cameron, which began in The Terminator and continued in Aliens. And if we were to talk about, some of Bill Paxton's least good work, we would also be led right back to some James Cameron movies. But let's deal in the positive as we say goodbye to Bill Paxton.
Absolutely.
Robert Osborne died at 84, film historian, primetime host of Turner Classic Movies since the cable network's inception in 1994. He lived in New York City, but shot his TCM appearances at the cable network's headquarters in Atlanta. He was,
I didn't know that.
He was, of course, TCM's primary on-air personality, and as such, he occupied something of a unique position in the history of television. Because it was once common for channels to provide hosts for the movies that they programmed. TCM, however, is now the last U.S. movie channel to regularly feature hosts who offer information about a film before it begins. Before the launch of TCM, Osborne had hosted films on the Movie Channel from 1986 to 1993. He started in show business as an actor, under contract to Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's Desilu. He made a few guest appearances on TV series, including The Beverly Hillbillies, appeared on stage in the Lucille Ball-produced The Desilu Review, a national tour of the play Generation with Robert Cummings, who starred in so many good Alfred Hitchcock movies, and the first production of Patty Chayefsky's The Latent Heterosexual, directed by Burgess Meredith and starring Zero Mostel. So you see, I mean, Robert Osborne's rubbing his elbows with the greats, all of whom really believed in him. Nevertheless, Ball, impressed by his college education, suggested that Osborne write a book, and they remained close friends until her death. He responded with a short history of the Academy Awards called Academy Awards Illustrated. And that led to stints as an entertainment reporter for television stations in Los Angeles and New York, and then to a similar regular gig on the CBS Morning News in the 1980s. He had joined the staff of The Hollywood Reporter in 77 and penned its Rambling Reporter column for almost 20 years. At TCM, as they sought to expand its brand beyond the small screen, he, of course, hosted the inaugural TCM Classic Film Festival in 2010 and subsequent editions in 2011, 12, 13, and 14. He took to the seas for the Classic Cruise from TCM in December 2011 and in subsequent years as well. And in addition to his TCM and AMPAS-related activities, he sponsored an annual classic film festival named after him at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communications. And that event was held from 2005 to 2010. I could go on and on about some interesting appearances that he made, but one in particular that we would be remiss if we did not discuss, because it's a classic that you turned me on to. He appears in an episode of Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, in an episode that's called Turner Classic Birdman.
Isn't that great? Where you actually see the original 1961 Birdman cartoon that he's introducing, that then Harvey Birdman is taken off from that. So it's like, oh, that's because you sort of remember as a kid, but thanks to Robert Osborne, he kind of lays it really clear. It's really a funny turn.
He was born in Colfax, Washington, served 2 years in the Air Force as a lieutenant, graduated from the University of Washington School of Journalism, and in addition to all his film and broadcast and journalism work, see, there's no matter how well you think you know someone, there's always more you don't know about them. He served, and maybe you did know this, but as a host and a narrator with several symphony orchestras, including the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, the Boston Pops, and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. And, Dean, can you address a rumor that in one of your new works of art, that might be unveiled in July at the gallery showing, that there might be a very subtle tribute to Robert Osborne in one of them?
Well, I can maybe neither confirm nor deny that rumor, but I would say maybe, yeah, that might happen.
There's a possibility of that.
Yes, that's what, exactly. All things are possible in multiple universes.
Okay, well, now you're making it sound like it's not possible. And I would like to believe...
It's totally happening.
It's totally happening. Okay, great. Here's a name that I feel got overshadowed. I don't think a lot of people celebrated this woman and what a life she led. And if you look her up, you immediately recognize her. Miriam Colon, born Miriam Colon Valle, born in 1936, was a Puerto Rican actress. She was a founder and director of the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater in New York City. When she was a girl in Puerto Rico, she was a great student in high school, and her grades were so good that she was awarded scholarships that enabled her to enroll in the Dramatic Workshop and Technical Institute and also in the Lee Strasberg Acting Studio in New York City.
Right.
She started on Broadway in the 1950s. She did countless episodes of TV, often playing the Mexican girl, right? Especially in Westerns. Three roles that stand out for me, and I think probably you as well, Dean. She played the redhead in Marlon Brando's One-Eyed Jax.
Exactly. One of my favorite Westerns.
Exactly. Played Tony Montana's mother in the Al Pacino version of Scarface, Mama Montana. Yeah. And recently played Tuco's Arbolita in Better Call Saul.
Oh, that's right.
In 1993, she received an Obie Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Theater. Her biography titled Miriam Colon, Actor and Theater, was written by Myra Fernandez. In 2000, she received the Hola Raul Julia Founders Award, Raul Julia Founders Award, although I never understood why it was a solid J and not a soft J, Raul Julia. But anyway, presented by the Hispanic Organization of Latin Actors, that's OLA. And in 2014, she was rewarded the National Medal of the Arts by President Barack Obama. Miriam Colon, who died at 81 years of age. No, or not quite 81. Years of age.
Right.
Finally, Robert James Waller. He was an American author best known, and see, there's that phrase again. Everybody uses it, best known.
There you go, yeah.
Like, we know him because that thing was popular. Most known for The Bridges of Madison County, an enormously successful book that was published in 93. He was also a photographer and a musician. In 97, his marriage of 35 years to his wife, Georgia, ended in divorce. And I think this is really interesting. An article in People magazine noted that the parallels between Waller's life and his art, his Bridges of Madison County heroine, farm wife Francesca, sacrifices her chance for happiness with a globe-hopping photographer in order to stay home and shield her loved ones from small-town scandal, haven't been lost on the locals. So apparently he revealed, maybe he is best known for Bridges of Madison County, because apparently he revealed a lot of his personal life in that book, so much so that his wife of 35 years, especially when the movie came out, had enough.
Wow. And said, I should have gone off with that globe-hopping photographer who came through town.
Oh, is that what you're thinking? I'm thinking that he was revealing about an affair that he had with the farmer, because he was the globe-hopping photographer. Well, now, see, we have more investigation to research on.
I'd say so. I thought he was writing about her and how she decided to stay with him and avoid small-town scandal, even though she was evidently in love with some other dude.
Okay, I'm going to have to look that up. That'll be on next week's show.
Right after I finish my Maximus 8 Hero User Guide to the Motherboard.
When you say you'll be looking it up, you mean if it's in a book about a motherboard. Okay. Well, the motherboard could be a farm wife, too. Okay. look, we also did not get the chance to discuss the Oscars, and I don't know if anybody cares 2 weeks later, but damn it, we care.
Right.
So we've got a few things to discuss. First of all, Jimmy Kimmel nailed it. Now, have you watched the show?
No. I haven't.
Great.
On my list of...
Great show. Not great Oscars. Great show. How often have we ever said that? Never.
Never.
About an Oscars? It was great television. Jimmy Kimmel nailed it. And it's not just that he did a great job as a host, because I'm sick of hearing that. What very few people have pointed out, but something that we have long stressed, you've got to take away the risk management that makes the show host-proof. It's got to be about the host. It's got to be a show where if the host kills it, the show works. And finally, they did that. This show was about its host. Jimmy Kimmel nails it. He gets the perfect tone. He's jokey and dry and sarcastic, but he also actually loves the town. He punctured the air out of the balloon elephant in the room, which was politics, by addressing everything, but doing it in such a way where, honestly, nobody really could stand up and make a political statement because it was already made by Kimmel in a subtle, funny, quick, restrained fashion. So it didn't leave room for anybody to bring the show to a partisan halt, which was extraordinary.
That's great.
So it was great. Now, that said, there are some problems that people keep talking about, one of which is the big whoops that was the in memoriam section this year.
Yes. The picture of the Australian editor who's still very much alive.
Well, so what do you start with? Do you start with them including someone who's alive, or do you start with them not including Gary Shandling, who's dead, not including Doris Roberts, who's dead, not including former Oscar-nominated actor Robert Vaughn, who's dead? I mean, if you're not even going to honor the people who were nominated for Oscars, why do you have an in memoriam? I'm not quite sure.
Well, there used to be a time when less people were dying, I suppose.
But that's a big oversight. An Oscar-nominated actor is a big oversight.
I'm not saying no. I'm just saying that 2016, as we know from our podcast, celebrity deaths took up like 50% of almost every show we did.
But one, and it still is, but one person experienced, as you pointed out, an unexpected feeling of surprise at the In Memoriam reel, a producer named Jan Chapman, who literally saw herself in the segment as in her picture. The Academy mistakenly used an image of producer Chapman while honoring Janet Patterson, a four-time Oscar-nominated costume designer who died in October. All in all, where was the QC going on for the In Memoriam? I mean, though, I can understand if deaths happened too recently for someone to include, but...
Yeah, Bill Paxton is a perfect example.
But you have all year to put this together, and you would think, I mean, certainly they have a lot of time. How are people not checking this? I mean, everybody's checking it within seconds of it airing. People are pointing out the problem. So clearly people know these things. That's stunning to me. It's unforgivable because it then overshadows what should have been touching tributes to the people who are in there.
Absolutely. And so I would think that the probable... thing the producers do is shuffle that off to interns to deal with will probably change in the future, particularly if it's this kind of sloppy internet work.
Well, this year they could have just blamed a certain accountant from PricewaterhouseCoopers because that person was going to be under the bus.
Poor guy.
Anyway, poor guy. I mean, okay, so let's address this. So yes, a PricewaterhouseCoopers accountant gets fired because he's been tweeting all during the show, Instagramming, taking photos, not paying attention to his job, and gives out the wrong envelope for Best Picture. Here's how this plays out for me. As soon as Best Picture La La Land is announced, I get an email from our loyal listener, Patrick B., who simply writes, "I feel your pain." And then there's all this activity on stage, people running around. Wait a minute. Has the wrong film been given an award? It sure would seem to be, since we can all see on camera that the envelope that Beatty is still holding says Best Actress in a Lead Role, not Best Picture, which begs the question, couldn't Warren read the envelope that he was handed? But anyway.
Well, I think that's what happened. That's why he looked at Faye Dunaway and gave it to her. Like, speaking of throwing under the bus.
But, Jesus. But so as soon as the revelation comes that La La Land has not won, I get a second email from Patrick B. that simply says, so WTF, you are saved. Publicity stunt? So, and this is what I heard at first, like it was some kind of publicity stunt, which I don't think it obviously could have been, because all I've heard afterwards is how this is the biggest mishap. This is the hugest, colossal disaster. People saying, what a shame. I mean, every show, every talking head, this is the most horrible thing that's ever happened in the Oscars history. And I honestly, I don't get it at all. I think it's the greatest thing that ever happened. Yeah. First of all, from a dramatic standpoint, Best Picture is always anticlimactic, not just in the sense that the favorite usually wins, but because you're putting on a show. And a climax to the show can't be, and the winner is, and then a speech. There needs to be a dramatic, you know, there should be some big final, how about closing the show with In Memoriam? That would be a great way to end a show. You need something big that people love to end a show. Just giving another award at the end of an award show is anticlimactic. You just end up going, okay, well, that happens. Let's tabulate our Oscar pool ballots. So this year, it actually ended with something dramatic. It ended as a show. So that's good. Also, you may have noticed that this was like the worst ratings ever in terms of viewership numbers for the Oscars. And there's several reasons for that. Obviously, television viewership tends to go down over time. But also, there weren't many big stars nominated. Last year, a very big ratings number for the Oscars, because huge international star Leonardo DiCaprio was a favorite to win. This affects the viewers' numbers. If big stars are nominated, they want to see them win. Secondly, most people had not seen many of the nominated movies. And that diminishes the ratings as well. Also, the fear that this year's show would be marred by so many expressions of partisan politics, I think kept people away from it as well.
Yeah.
And once they hear about the show and see clips from it, I think they will come back to it. And if Jimmy Kimmel's invited to come next year, I think then you'll see the ratings really bump up, because people will have seen so many clips, will have watched it after the fact, and will go, okay, good, we know we can watch this show. It's going to be fun for everybody. But the other thing that's going to spike those ratings is, let's face it, for years to come, everyone's going to tune in to see if there's another disaster like this.
Yes, exactly. Which chances are there won't be. I mean, Price Waterhouse, not only did that guy get fired, but that other executive was in line to run Paramount, and now he's out of the running. So his vertical career projection went out the window. So I think that whole accounting company is going to be giving it its stern eye.
You feel for those guys that come and take the stage and they think they've won, and then they have it taken away from them. Obviously, look, that can't be fun. But it was great that they showed them rather than announcing it, so that producer Jordan Horowitz had at least a moment to form a relationship to the reality himself, rather than having it thrust upon him under the spotlight, you know, in that way. In that moment, he was Sisyphus. What relationship does he want to have to pushing that rock back up the hill? And what I love is Jordan Horowitz gave a speech about the need to, for empathy in our storytelling. And it was a really aspirational speech. And then what I loved is that he then got the opportunity to embody and demonstrate those things by how he announced that the winner was Moonlight, and how he celebrated their victory. And it was
absolutely.
It really demonstrated so many things. Everybody's saying that it's a disaster. Quite honestly, we have a shortage of people who are gracious winners in this world. And so, therefore, the example of gracious losers is almost nil. And here was an example of someone behaving in the best manner possible, not for just an entertainment figure, but for people. Things will go wrong in our lives, and we got, and sometimes they'll go wrong under a huge spotlight, under a huge microscope, and we got an example of how human beings are capable of responding in those moments.
Right. So let's celebrate that.
Yeah. And honestly, because of how he handled it, like Lily said, that guy's walking around with a gigantic Hollywood gold card. Now, he could murder someone on the streets and get away with it after that.
That's right. Him and Trump.
Apparently. I'm not advocating that he does that. But anyway, no. So I thought all in all, it was remarkable, and it was actually cool to see how that played out.
I agree.
So, Dean Haglund, there's been it's been an interesting year for movies, the Oscars notwithstanding. I have been struck by, you know, we talked at length about John Wick 2 a few weeks ago. We had on Chad Osuna to discuss it as well. But I think it's really interesting that we've had, in just the last couple months, one of the 10 all-time best action movies ever made, for my money, John Wick 2. Comes out. A few weeks ago, we have one of the 10 best all-time horror films. If we were doing our top 10 horror films of all time now, I might have to change the list, because clearly on that list, and maybe higher rather than lower on the top 10, is Jordan Peele's Get Out.
I'm so excited for that to get to my screen somehow.
Not only a great movie, but you're going to be hard-pressed to find... how many films get nominated now for Best Picture? 8, 9, something like that. Anywhere between 5 and 10 can be nominated. You're going to be hard-pressed to find 5 to 10 pictures this year that are more important than Get Out. Certainly going to be hard pressed to find 5 or 10 that are funnier than Get Out. And oh, by the way, it's a horror film. So here's a couple of genres that right out of the chutes to start this year, we have just unbelievably great exemplars of. And so it was with great enthusiasm, I must admit, that I line up at the Directors Guild to see Logan, because I've been hearing that James Mangold's X-Men spinoff, the final Hugh Jackman performance as Wolverine, is perhaps the best comic book movie of all time. This is the advance word on this thing. And I can understand why people think it's so good. It is very well done. It captures a certain action grittiness and a certain, class conscience verisimilitude, both of which remind me of last year's Hell or High Water, quite honestly. Much so that I really wished I was watching Hell or High Water. The movie Logan is so well done that it almost seems like it's about something, while being literally about nothing. It gets lucky that when it comes out is in a post-Trump America, so it seems like it has something to say, because really it doesn't have anything to say. And so if you like comic book movies, I think you might end up saying, wow, this is really great. But if you don't like comic book movies, you say, as I did, is that my ass that's getting so sore? So.
Oh, no. Yeah. But I thought there was so much great acting. I thought, I hear Patrick Stewart's so phenomenal.
He is phenomenal. And Hugh Jackman is so phenomenal, but in a way that's really kind of sad, because I'm watching Hugh Jackman going, all right, with the exception of Les Miserables, what was Hugh Jackman's great movie role other than Les Miserables? Like, has he ever... It's weird. Like, we've all always known who Hugh Jackman is, but I can't off the top of my head think of any great Hugh Jackman films or vehicles.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, he...
There's Wolverine and Les Miserables.
Well, he's done a lot of stage work.
Right, but that's what I'm saying, is that he's kind of never found the thing other than Wolverine. So it sort of was sad for me in that way. And also, people keep combining how Fox has really found something with their X-Men offshoots with Deadpool and Wolverine. And I think it is such an unfair comparison in that, yes, Wolverine has the kind of intense R-rated bloodletting that comic book and superhero movie audiences seem to be ready for these days. But Deadpool was as funny as they come. And in true X-Men fashion, this Logan movie is almost humorless, except when it tries to be funny, when it is absolutely deadening.
Oh, my God. So you're saying that...
I'm saying the Emperor has no clothes. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Well, I think Deadpool is a movie that is startlingly sophisticated. That its tone and its presentation belie what an incredible challenge that movie was to put together. And I would say...
And 13 years in the making, apparently.
And I would say that the overt qualities of Wolverine misdirect away from the fact that they put nothing together.
Oh... Now I'm going to go see this. This was not on my list of must-sees, but now I'm intrigued by the conflicting, because, you know, you often have a review that is counterintuitive to most of the chatter out there, and I often agree with your assessments on a lot of things when I finally come around to see them. A few things, you know, notwithstanding, but... this now has compelled me to go, oh, I should see this in order to determine where your opinion alters from the rest of humanity.
I would say that, though, my opinion where it differs often is incredibly prescient, however. History tends
to toot your own horn.
History tends to... No, I mean, we've been doing this show long enough now where you can go back in here. History tends to be fairly kind to my dismissal of what is getting... When I dismiss something that is getting great consensus in terms of love and admiration, when I dismiss those, history tends to be very kind to me, as it will be with La La Land.
Yes, I agree. I am there with you on that 100%. So,
all right.
Awesome.
Well, look at all the stuff we got to. We got to movies. Yeah. We got to the Oscars, celebrity deaths.
What we're reading,
art. It's good to be back with just a kind of an old-fashioned, hard-boiled, knockdown, free-spirited, grab bag of topics on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Hugh Jackman. Real Steel. Remember the robot fighting film? He was incredible in that. I think.
Oh my God. No, I know. I can name films. The question was not to name Hugh Jackman films. Australia. Swordfish. That thing where he plays like some French royalty who's traveled through time. I don't know. Eddie the Eagle. But they're just... He's not really been given great... stuff to do, right?
I see what you're saying. Okay.
It's really interesting. Okay. Anyway, that brings us to the end of another, we hope, enjoyable installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review. Review what the hell you just heard about.
Yeah, you know, it's been a little while since we've got a review. We want to hear from you. If you listen to this show, why not write an iTunes review? What could be more fun? Us on Facebook, won't you?
Like us.
Yeah, we're facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Dean,
yep.
Can people follow us on Twitter and Instagram? How can they do that?
With the same thing, by just writing Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
That's
so easy.
Handle. Once a week, we post a fun little photo or a diptych of photos. I said diptych. and hashtag.
I'm not showing those.
We give good hashtag. Finally, write us. ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. Tell us what you want us to talk about, if we have anything to add to the topic. And if we find it interesting, we'll be happy to bring it up. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And also, as we said at the outset, if you want information about how you can see our movie, The Lady Killers, this March here in Southern California, drop us a line. Until next week, I guess all that's left to be said is I'm Phil Lairness.
And I'm Dean Haglund. We'll see you then.
Belated spoiler alert.